Anton Delica is a saxophonist, a composer, and he has a new recording out called The Offering on Earshift Records. And he is our very special guest on this episode of the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast. Welcome back to another edition of the Australian Jazz and Groove Podcast. It's been a little while since the last episode over the Christmas break here in 2021 to 22, but it's great to be back into our 20th episode. So thanks for all your support and all those that have been tuning in on a regular basis, and all those that are new to the podcast, welcome, and we hope you enjoy it. And by all means, please spread the word so we can help spread the love of these fantastic Australian composers and artists. Well, what do we have in store for, as we said, our 20th episode? Well, in the intro, we mentioned we have a special guest, and his name is Anton Delica. Now, Anton is a native Melburnian, and he has a great new recording out on Earshift Records called The Offering, which is a direct follow-up from his previous album, The Healer. And he'll talk a little bit about that and how the two were related. He'll also be talking to us about how this album came to be made in New York, and also his time studying in New York and all the great people he got to meet and hang out with. We'll also hear a new track off the latest recording from Mike Nock, Hamish Stewart, Jonathan Schwartz and Julian Wilson, an album called Another Dance. And you may recall on episode 5 of this podcast, we spoke with Julian Wilson about their first album that this group put out called This World. And we got to hear some great tracks off that. So we'll hear a new track off Another Dance, as we said, their follow-up to This World. So to get us into the music, let's start with a killer groove track from Sydney's Avgenikis Brothers. Now, this is a track from their latest recording entitled Treading Water. This recording was released in September of 2020, and the personnel on this recording is made up of Tom Avgenikis on trumpet, Michael Avgenikis on saxophone, Felix Leyland on guitar, Novak Manelovic on keys and synth, Nick Henderson on bass, and Alex Hurlian on drums. So let's start the title track from that album, which is entitled Treading Water, and this is the Avgenikis Brothers.
Thank you.
So that was the Afghanicus Brothers from their latest recording, Treading Water, out on Earshift Records. So go to Bandcamp and you can download their really cool album, some great tracks on that, as so many other artists are on that Earshift label. So now we've come to our special guest, Anton Delica, and he has a new recording out, as we said, called The Offering. The band on this recording are just killing it and are so young, as you'll hear Anton talk about. So before we talk to Anton, let's listen to the title track from this, which has Anton Delica on tenor saxophone, Kaylee O'Doherty on piano, Matt Cloese on acoustic bass, Corey Cox on drums, and Emmanuel Wilkins on alto saxophone. So here is The Offering. Anton Delica, welcome to the Australian Jazz and Groove podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. And got so much to talk to you about, but you've got a new album out called The Offering, which will be released on November the 18th, the Jazz Lab. Is that correct?
It's actually released already online, and, you know, we're selling CDs. People still buy them, thankfully. But yeah, we're doing the launch I'm doing the launch with my quintet in Melbourne on the 18th of November.
Yeah, fantastic. At the Jazz Lab. Yeah. Excellent. So in the notes that I read about the album, it says it's the sister recording to The Healer, which you released in 2013. So in what way is it the sister album to that? Is there some sort of connection with the two?
Yeah, it came to me when I was naming it, and it actually was sort of through the help of a graphic designer, because I was looking at the name and I was like, oh, The Offering, it sounds a bit like The Healer, it's a bit maybe spiritual. The fact is, it is a spiritual trip for me, this whole deal. I had a lot of issues when I was younger with drugs and alcohol, and I got clean, and so that The Healer was the first record where that entire record is about that stuff, about the process and the spiritual growth that has come from that sort of way of being and path of, you know, abstinence being one of the things that I engage in. And this has been sort of like the taking it further in a way, that side of things, but also sort of going out into the world a little bit and doing some stuff that I didn't have the opportunity to do when I was younger, which is, go and live overseas for a period of time. And, I've had a lot of support from my wife and her family. And I guess I have a certain amount of mental stability, now, which I did not have previously. So I was able to do it. New York's a tough city, like it really is. And so moving over there was very challenging, but it was so. In a sense, it's sort of like a more out in the world version of The Healer. Like The Healer, in a way, was an almost insular for me, and this is sort of. I mean, I only really have started to feel like I'm growing and moving ahead in life in the last 10 years, really, quite honestly. And of course, it's so funny because you get older and you're like, whoa, why didn't this happen 20 years ago? But it's fine. It just happens when it happens. But this is, so this record is a similar kind of trajectory as in most of the stuff on the record is personal stuff for me. It's just how I write. It's just how I go about it. Occasionally there's a song which is simply just based on a groove, you know, there's that kind of idea, but most of it there's something underlying for me. And this is sort of like, it's like The Healer except further. I don't necessarily mean it's a higher level recording, but although I think it is, because I play better, but the bands are both amazing. So the sort of content is similar, but this is a little bit further along, I guess you would say, but it's still that spiritual stuff, you know, which is really where I'm at these days with the music and the life. I don't, you know, the technical side of things it interests me in the practice room, but it doesn't particularly interest me in performing and writing,
I noticed when listening to the recording that there was a huge element of groove in it. And even though, for want of a better word, we can call it a jazz recording, or as we were talking before, Black American music, that's where your influences come from. Can you tell us about how you write in that style and how these tunes come to you in this sort of, because there is a deep groove there, which as a, you know, electric bass player and a double bass player, I love to hear that in jazz. So that's what really turned it on for me. But is that just something that you naturally fall into and write in that manner when you compose?
No, it's definitely intentional. I learned a lot from playing with the Bamboos and Lance Ferguson, the guy that ran that band, or he runs that band, you know, like I learned a lot from that time. And And I've always loved playing for dancers as well. Yeah. And even big band music, I play in the B-sharp big band here, and you know, we play for dancers, and it's getting back to the meaning of that for me, I mean, I just the power and the feeling and that drive, you know, we were talking about a gig I used to see when I first went to New York with Brian Blade and Sam Yale, Scott Colley. The drive in that music really struck me, even though they were often playing very lightly or very subtly, you know, very quietly. It still had power and feel. And one of my favorite tenor players is modern current tenor players is Ravi Coltrane. And I remember seeing him, you know, a couple of years back, and it just blew my mind, the power of in the music. And that's the stuff that grabs me. And it comes from African American roots, and I'm really that means a lot to me, and I just try to pay respect to that, you know, in the music, you know, we did a Horace Silver tune. I particularly like Horace Silver's writing and playing in his bands, and
that's Barbara, isn't it? That's the track.
Yeah, Barbara. Yeah,
it's a great arrangement.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. I was really excited because he's Horace Silver's son actually had to okay that for me to be able to put that YouTube. So I was pretty stoked by that. But the groove and the power of the music is the stuff that matters to me, and I just that's the stuff that moves me. If music doesn't move me or make me feel anything, I just don't listen to it. It's as simple as that. And you know, like. And that's not because, you see, like, for example, I love Bill Evans, a piano player, and, you know, I guess, you know, he's clearly a white American player, but that has just got the feel, it's got the power in it, even though it's light to the touch, you know. So it's not detracting in any way from white musicians at all. For me, it's just acknowledging that the black roots of the music.
I remember reading on your website that for a while there you felt like you were stagnating in Melbourne, and then you went to do your master's in the States. Mm. How did New York drag you out of that stagnation type period or feeling?
Yeah, and it was, it, you know, it's that funny thing, you know, isn't it? Like I was having, and I knew it at the time, and I said it to my wife, like I'm doing great gigs. I was touring around with the Bamboos and playing with the Meltdown at the time and doing lots of great gigs and blah, 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 blah. But I just felt really stuck as far as I couldn't get any further where I was at. Mm. And I'm not massively fond of studying as such informal in a formal institution, but I felt that that was going to be a great way for me to structure. Does work for me, really. It really helps someone like myself. And I wanted to do a master's, and I just didn't want to do a master's here. I wanted to get the knowledge and that depth that you get over there. And I did get into Manhattan School, and I did want to go to Manhattan School, but I didn't get the scholarship, and I kind of buggered up the first application with that scholarship. And and according to Des White, my friend, the bass player, said, yeah, you probably stuffed that up. So that was cool. So I went to Queen's College, which turned out to be really fantastic for me. And the level of teachers and musicians that teach, you know, the professors, it's absolutely sensational program. So I sort of got what I needed and wanted as far as the course. And that it really did break me out of where I was at, you know.
Mm.
And it was not, it's no reflection on Melbourne specifically. It's really just a reflection on myself and where I was at in the head at the time, you know.
Mm.
You know that thing when you're sort of just a bit stuck and you don't quite know where to go to get better, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like you had to have, you know, a change of scene is like a holiday, or, you know, circumstances is like a holiday. That's just that refreshing thing. Mm. So being surrounded by, you know, someone said to me once, New York's full of amazing players, but just as many not amazing players. It's just not like, you know, Australia, it doesn't mean you can't play jazz because you come from Australia. But just being around so many amazing musicians, did that also help you just sort of have to lift in a way, or just naturally lifted you?
Yeah, the thing I like about that place is I just get motivated like immediately. Like just motivates me. I particularly just like the city. I'm that one of those people that like the city. I like the boroughs, and I like where we were living in Queens. And, you know, I like bagels and coffee. Yeah. And, you know, like I just like all that.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it is fairly intimidating, like no doubt. Like you go there and you go and play and you hear people play, and a lot of people really do have a freak out when they get there. And I'd been there previously, you know, and I've traveled a fair bit, and I've, you know, so I was aware of, you know, the kind of musicians. I think that there's a lot of, I can't speak about now after COVID, but it still seems still similar. Like there are a lot of kind of genius level type people that end up living there because it just gravitate, you know, those kind of people gravitate there. And Australians have got a fantastic reputation there because of some of the amazing musicians from here.
Mm.
So that's really changed since the last time I was there years and years ago, where Australians were really non-existent, maybe except for Dale Barlow, who was really much more on the peak end of things.
Yeah.
But now there's people like Troy Roberts, Matt Dodrell was there for years. You know, many people know Matt. Linda Mayhart. You know, just incredible musicians, you know. So Australians have a really good reputation, and Australians play really well, you know.
Mm.
It just is, for myself, I mean, one of the real key points, certainly in the jazz world, was my repertoire. It really needed updating, because for myself to go out and play or play at sessions in houses or in clubs, you just need to know a lot of tunes. And I knew a fair few tunes, but not enough.
Yeah, right.
You know, not well enough.
Yeah. So that scene still still exists, where, because we're talking about tunes that a lot of them were in the 30s and 40s and 50s where they were like popular music at the time, but it's still that need to know those tunes even today, hey?
Yeah, and certainly a lot of the sort of slightly more modern tunes, Chick Corea tunes, Wayne tunes, Joe Henderson kind of tunes. I love all that. I love playing those tunes. Some people don't, and there are people in New York that don't play those tunes. I like playing them. I find it really helps to inform my writing and my playing. So if I learn a Joe Henderson tune, it helps my playing, it helps my writing, and I get an insight into how he sort of worked to an extent. And I have transcribed him also as well. But, you know, like I love that. I personally love that aspect of it. And there are people in Melbourne that are like that too. I think Phil Noy, you know, has had Bob Stretch for years, and he just knows all these tunes. Mm. He knows a lot of tunes. And that is, for me, it's a great thing. And I love that about being able to come together and with people you don't even know and playing a tune. And it lifts the level of the original music.
Right. So it does inform original music in a way, doesn't it?
For me, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, like I've been working on Dolphin Dance, Herbie's tune.
Yep.
Like for a while. So heavy, that tune. And Herbie's harmony. I mean, I love it. And I that's the kind of stuff that helps to inform what I'm playing and what I'm writing. I mean, I wouldn't ever have that kind of level of sophistication, but just simply to be playing those tunes in itself, I find helpful. Some don't, but I do.
Mm. Do you feel that traveling, going to live in New York as an older person, because we were talking before, not that you're old, but you know,
I'm old enough.
Yeah. Did you find that was better to have? And we've talked before about some of the tragic things that you've gone through in your life. Did you find that sort of you were able to cut through all the other stuff that we worry about as young musicians and who's in the room and trying to impress this or that? Do you find that all that was gone because you were older and you had that more maturity and you could go there and just go, you know what, I'm just going to take what I can out of this place?
Yeah, I think there's definitely an element. I mean, certainly the first couple of times I played, I was very nervous, again, just simply going out and playing, and I'd built it up a bit, and I knew that would happen. But then eventually I just was getting up with anyone and playing. Okay. The last time I played was at the Bando Jam with Troy Roberts, and he was, you know, kicking my rear end. But I don't care because I'm there to learn and I'm there to play, and I have my style. I'm very happy with what I say when I play, you know. So for me, I think I noticed that too, even in the course. Like, I was just so thankful to be learning from such incredible musicians and teachers and the level of those professors. I mean, I have been around and I know what that means. I think maybe some of the people in the course didn't really appreciate that because they're American or whatever and they've been used to that. Mike Mossman, who ran, you know, who taught arranging, you know, ran the Carnegie Hall Jazz Orchestra, you know, works with the WDR all the time, you know, teaches at Juilliard and blah, blah, all that. And he's just a great guy. It's great to learn from, you know. And but so that stuff means a lot to me. I'm like a typical adult learner. Yeah. Like, I said to my wife, like, I could spend another 2 years here just eating this up, you know.
Yep.
And it is intimidating, the level and the talent of people. Queen's College, it was, some students were mid-level, some were very high, like the piano player on my record, Kaylee, who I went through there with. And there are some, you know, I think Chris Cheek's there at the moment, the tenor player. You know, there are sort of high-end New York musicians who go through, you know, they want a master's, whatever, and there's great education there.
Yeah, right.
I think, you know, not drinking, well, America, they don't have a huge drinking culture. It's not really such a thing in the jazz world. Young jazz players are more like young university professors to me nowadays. It's not like it was back in the day. You know, they're very nerdy often and very good. Just so good. It's incredible. You know, the first time I got up to play on a session, on a jam session, this young guy, Chris Bittner, who is a fantastic young player, he sort of finished Juilliard or something, you know, he's fantastic. And I was like, I called this tune, I'll Be Seeing You. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can kind of hear it. Mm. I mean, I sort of heard it, but actually I later learned it and realized it's got a lot in it. And I really should not have gotten up and played on that tune because he destroyed me. But it was great.
Yeah.
You know, like I just love meeting, and I love meeting people and talking to people. And to me, they're all young. They're just young people. And, you know, it's so funny. You know, some people are like, one guy I was playing with, he's like, oh, I shouldn't have left New York. I've ruined my life. And, you know, I've been doing these theater shows. This guy plays flute, clarinet, reads like a gun. You know, he's back in New York living. And he's like early 30s.
Yeah,
he learned off Jerry Bergonzi at New England Conservatory. I'm like, dude, it's fine. Don't worry. I'm nearly 50. Not over. Don't worry about it.
Yeah,
I mean, I enjoyed the. It's really just a headspace. No one really tripped out on me for being older. It's more just you have that headspace, and I like that about it. You know, there's a lot of just a very enthusiastic people. And if people get vibey and are not cool, there's enough good people to just ignore them.
Yeah.
You know,
no, that's cool. Yeah. So you talked about Kaylee O'Doherty. Is that her name, the piano player?
Yeah, Kaylee,
So how did you get this band together for the recording? Because they're listening to it. It's just absolutely beautiful, killing grooves, and that, and love the drumming on it. So, yeah, talk about these guys in the band? Because it's just a great for Australians to be turned on to these guys.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I will say Matt is originally from Melbourne, and he played on my very first recording, you know. So Matt and I are good friends.
That's Matt Cloisey?
Yeah.
And Matt's been bass sounds mighty on this recording. Oh, he's absolutely mighty, beautiful.
Yeah, he's an incredible musician, and he's a beautiful guy, and he always was a beautiful guy, and always was an incredible musician. You know, like just again, sort of intimidatingly good.
Mm.
But yeah, so I've known Matt for a long time, and I wasn't 100% sure he would do it. You know, he plays with sort of Seamus Blake and.
Yeah.
Jonathan Kreisberg and all these people, but he was writing to it. And Kaylee, I met at Queen's College, and she's just clearly, as you can hear, like she's a superlative musician. Most of the people, a lot of people in New York, have been through Berkeley. So she was a Berkeley person, and sort of got. I think she could have done the masters there, but wanted to move to New York, you know.
Mm.
And so I met Kaylee at Queen's College, and we both did the Louis Armstrong sort of program. There's the Louis Armstrong archives are at Queen's College. So he trumpets and all these tapes. And so there's a real Louis Armstrong. It's incredible. Like,
wow, I didn't even know about that.
Yeah. So all of, a lot of his stuff is there. They're rebuilding the house museum. But so I did that with Kaylee, and we got to know each other, and we played a bit. And then I got to meet Corey, her husband, who's on the record.
I met
Corey actually just playing. Like, I played with him at a session. Kaylee was playing, and I just love this drummer. This drummer is like, the thing that I love about it is that it's like talking, you know, with someone like Corey. It's like you're playing with them. It's so interactive and really, you know, the driving feel, as we were talking about just before. And it's almost conversational as well. And I love that. Like, I really play off the drums. I really like that kind of thing. And so, you know, I asked if maybe he could do it. I knew he was super busy. And Kaylee, they're all kind of crazy busy. And then Emmanuel, I'd heard a friend of mine was studying at
That's Emmanuel Julia. Wilkins. Emmanuel Wilkins.
Yeah. And I heard him in a recital, just a recital that I went to go and see. And I was just like, this guy's incredible. And then I thought, he's so good, he must be an asshole. Like, he's just too good and he's too young. And I just happened to bump into him outside with a bunch of the kids. You know, they're, you know, young kids and they're all kind of incredible. And he was just really lovely, you know, really lovely guy and really nice to speak to. And because that stuff's important to me. Like, I'm not going to, you know, pay someone to be on a recording if they're not cool. I mean, who wants that? No one wants that, you know.
Yeah.
No. The people that were going to be on that on the recording were people I think are cool, you know. He is a beautiful guy.
Yeah,
cool. And I was like, you know, and I thought, look, I really want an alto on a few tracks. And I thought, look, he's basically the best alto player I'd heard of the young people, you know, in New York. And who really had something special. So I just asked him and he agreed to it. So I was really excited about that because, and again, it's quite intimidating because Emmanuel doesn't really play bad solos. And they're all really different. They're all really creative. So I noted on the recording how sort of he was just sort of cool with it, you know, what he played. And he really was, I mixed that record and I heard his solos over and over again. I could just keep listening to them.
Yeah.
My own solos, no. But his solos, I was, you know, because of course with yourself, you're judging yourself and
yeah, totally.
You know. But so that's how they all came together. And for me, the vibe is important. And Kaylee's, I knew, and you know, she was always fantastic, very supportive, and Corey as well, and very masterful. When I went and played with Kaylee, I basically got my ass kicked, like completely.
Yeah.
Like she, you know, it was only the first month or so I was in New York and I went over and we had a play and I just went, I've got a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah. And that's what you go there for, hey. That's where you went there. It was like in that you had that straight up, which was great.
Yeah. And I'm not the cheap. Said any, you know, it was just like for myself, I was like, you've got a lot of work to do, and that was cool. And I did put a lot of work in, you know, that's been the challenging thing about not really specifically about being in Melbourne necessarily, but the lockdown. You've been coming back to Melbourne and then the lockdown happened. And for myself, I don't know about you, but the motivation has been really challenging.
Yeah, I've heard a few people have said that, and I could imagine that coming from New York with all of this momentum into a lockdown, that must have been tough because you'd come back all informed for this great experience, and then all of a sudden it's just like you hit a wall.
Yeah, it was last year was a shocker. I mean, for so many people, you know, I think you know, I kind of really wanted to go back, and then of course COVID was. Clearly that wasn't going to happen and, you know, it's certainly not going to happen this year. You know, and again, it's that energy that I get from it, you know, and there are just so many people with a similar headspace, which is just simply a great love of playing and a real enthusiasm for it like I have, you know. And but there are people here with that kind of feeling, and that's what I'm doing. I'm playing with them, you know, and sort of just setting up situation to get playing again. And I don't mean just always paid, like I just like playing. I love it.
So this new band that you've got, you're gigging on, and when this podcast comes out, it would have already happened, this gig. But the band that you've got together, are they playing tunes from the album, or and also any new material as well?
There is new material, and I've been writing a bit, not enough. I have so many ideas. Like, I've got a million voice memos on my phone. It's just that thing of, for me at the moment, I sort of lost the motivation a bit during the lockdown. I've got sort of one tune I'd like to try to get finished before the rehearsal on Monday. I have some other new tunes I've brought onto the gig.
Yep.
Pardon me. I don't know how much I like them.
Yeah.
So, you know how it is. Like, I write them and you play them, and I think one of them I quite like, but it's really hard to play. I might just hold off on that for next week, because this will be my first full-on gig, you know, for like 8 months or something, months or whatever it was. Yeah. So, you know, we will be doing that one called The Fight, which is very fast. It's cool. Like, Danny Fisher's on drums. With Danny on drums, it's all good. You know, Danny's got the drive.
Yeah. I'd love to hear, actually, one of the recordings that stood out to me, one of the tracks, there's about five of them that I wrote down, but one that I really dug was Promises, Promises. And
the groove
on that was like, and I, if I get to the gig, I'd love to hear that, because I just thought it was like super fat. The bass was killing. The rhythm section was great, but it was just really laid back groove. Like, it was just and to hear that, you know, we hear this beautiful music, and I'm a big fan of modern jazz where it's all very eclectic and it's got that ECM edge, which I love that stuff. I really
do.
To be able to hear that though, to hear that groove there, that gospel-y type thing, I really dug that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I like that a lot too. And, the Corey is like an absolute master of that, the drummer. So, I mean, that's just one of the things. He was doing some broken beat kind of stuff on it too, on a couple of the other takes. And so he was really getting deep. And Matt is a groove meister, the drummer. The bass player. So, you know, like, and I wrote that in the 90s, that tune. I used to play that in the 90s. And I'd recorded it for the ABC, and that it never got released as a record. It was just for the radio show. And then I kind of left it, and I played it over the years. But finally, I'm an R about it, actually. I asked Lance, do you think I should record this on this record? He's like, definitely. So I thought, all right, we'll do it. I mean, it's just a simple, I think it's five chord thing, but you know, it's fun, and it's the power of the groove. You know, I don't know how it'll come up next week with this kind of band that I have here, but you know, because that is a particular kind of New York American thing, I guess, you get on that record. You know, that there's a real deep feel there, but I'm sure it'll be killing. And I haven't actually played that tune with the band here, so I literally printed it out the other day. So,
well, I think that tune, it's like you were saying, it's a New York thing. You probably, the only place you could probably have recorded that to get that vibe would have been like, it's like at the right place, right time kind of recording that track.
Yeah, I think in the States period, I mean, you know, I played with great bands here that play that style, but they won't necessarily be doing that kind of jazz improvising. So, like the Bamboos or the Meltdown, or you know, there's so many great groove bands, but this is a bit of a in between, isn't it? Because it is a recording, and it's but it's still got that sensibility behind it. You know, it was a lot of fun recording that.
Hey, Anton, it's been totally awesome having you on the podcast, and we really appreciate you taking the time. And the best of luck with The Offering, the new album, which I have to tell everyone, just go and buy it, go to Bandcamp, buy it. It's just absolutely killer. And
particularly on Fridays, David.
Fridays, exactly. Bandcamp, that's right. Fridays. Bandcamp Friday is becoming a thing that people need to get on board with. So yeah, because the artist gets 100% of the royalties, don't they, when they do that Bandcamp Friday?
I mean, obviously the label gets some, et cetera, but yeah, we get a lot more of the royalties on Fridays, which is a really great thing they're doing. Bandcamp's fantastic. So
Bandcamp's awesome, yeah. And that's where I downloaded it from. So it's a great place. You get it instantly, get it in all the different forms you want. So I just encourage everyone to go out and if, you know, hope have a good gig, which would have happened by now, but I'm sure it'll be awesome and I hope to get along to it. And that's the challenge we have of doing podcasts in advance. But but thanks so much for being on the show and look forward to talking to you again, mate.
Ah, thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
So that was Promises, Promises from The Offering. And a big thank you to Anton Delica for taking the time to talk through this music and how he was able to make that album with such a fine young band. And please support the band and Anton and many of the other artists by going and downloading that album from the Earshift record label on Bandcamp. It's the best way to support them. Well, to close out the show, let's go to a new track from the Mike Nock, Hamish Stewart, Jonathan Schwartz, Julian Wilson project. And the title of the new album is called Another Dance. And this is a composition, I believe it's the very first track from the album. It's one by Mike Nock and it's called Deception. So enjoy this off Another Dance. So that was a great Mike Knott composition called Deception from the album Another Dance. And as we said, it featured Mike on piano, Hamish Stewart on drums, Jonathan Schwartz on bass, and Julian Wilson on tenor saxophone. Well, that's the end of the show, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode number 20. Big thank you to Anton Delica for taking the time to talk to us. And please tune into the next episode when we'll be featuring an interview from Western Australian big band composer Mace Francis. Some really interesting discussions that we had about big band music. But until then, please continue to support the podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, please go to AustralianJazzAndGroovePodcast@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with us on Facebook. But please let us know who you'd like to hear. If you have any particular music you'd like played, please send it through to us. But it's been so fantastic to bring you 20 episodes of the podcast, and we look forward to doing another 20 more. But until then, that's all from me, and bye for now.